President Lincoln is best known for ending slavery, but he also ushered in a new era. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. 1860 turned out to be a pivotal moment in American history. It saw not only the beginning of the end of slavery, but also the groundwork for a new industrial nation. David Reynolds has authored a new book entitled Abe, Abraham Lincoln and His Times, which traces the cultural changes as well as the political that shaped the man we now know as the Great Emancipator. And we have him on the phone this morning. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Don. Thank you.
So give me a sense, by the way, about the cultural and political milieu in which he enters certainly public life, and you describe it as the Puritans or Roundheads from Cromwell, as opposed to the Cavaliers.
Yeah, the North, the anti-slavery people in the North kind of traced themselves ideologically back to the Puritans and people like Cromwell, who were kind of fighting for human rights and so forth in Great Britain, and also the early American, Mayflower people and so forth, as opposed to the Cavaliers, who were the Southern people, who were steeped in tradition and honor, and also they believed in hierarchy, which is why they endorsed slavery in part. So there was this kind of cultural background of North versus South, and people at that time a lot of times said, it's really a war about the Puritan versus the Cavalier. And the thing about Lincoln is that on his father's side, he was traced back to Puritan New England, Samuel Lincoln, who came over in 1637. And on his mother's side, he traced back to Virginia and a kind of planter, a Southern planter. So some people viewed him as kind of the combination of the Puritan and the Cavalier, and that he had both the Cavalier sense of honor and all of that, but a long time the kind of moral commitment and the devotion to human rights that came from the Puritan Revolution of the 1640s and the kind of separatists who came over to America and settled America and rebelled against the hierarchy of the Anglican Church in England at the time. So people were, looked at him and saw him as kind of a combination of the two.
Now, does that then indicate sort of his balancing act that he seems to do in terms of the pro-slavery versus anti-slavery and this perhaps even a balancing between the two cultures, as it were?
Yeah, he compared himself to the most famous tightrope walker of his era named Blondin, Charles Blondin, who in 1859 made many crossings of Niagara Falls, sometimes with a man on his back, sometimes pushing a wheelbarrow. This was without a net, of course. It's about 1,200 feet across Niagara Falls. And Lincoln compared himself several times to Blondin, as did many other people, cartoonists and everything of his day, because as much as he hated slavery, and personally he was close to African Americans and everything, but he knew that he didn't want to inflame cultural hostilities even further. And this is why he kind of positioned himself as Blondin, because he knew that in a very divided time, the worst thing you can do is to play to a political base. You have to, in his words, have malice toward none and charity to all.
So in terms of his relationship to slavery, how do you see him then navigating this? Because he doesn't come out and say that he opposes slavery in the sense of repealing it. But on the other hand, he talks about the idea of not its expansion, being against its expansion. And he ultimately, obviously, becomes a great emancipator. Describe that arc for me.
Oh, sure. Well, at the beginning of the war, he said, or before the Civil War, which begins in 1861, he said, we Republicans, back then the Republicans were the liberals, and the Democrats were the conservatives. And he said, we're willing to leave slavery where it is because the Constitution says the federal government can't really interfere with slavery, but we don't want it to expand into the federal territories in the West. There were many open territories at that time. And he and fellow Republicans thought that by containing slavery where it was, that eventually it would die off almost like rotting fruit off of a vine. But if it was allowed to spread, well, back then the Democrats and the Southerners, who were the conservatives, really had visions of taking over the West and also taking over Cuba and Mexico, and slavery would have gone crazy if it was allowed to expand. So he was very firm, though, about forbidding its expansion. And when he was president, that's why he took up arms against the South when the South attacked Fort Sumter, started the Civil War. He called up troops, and there was 4 years of civil war. 750,000 Americans died, and he opposed slavery as much as any abolitionist, but he had this kind of moderate public stance because he didn't really want to inflame. There were a lot of anti-Lincoln people in the North. He didn't want to inflame the hostilities there, and he also wanted to keep the border states. There were five states that were that held slaves, Kentucky and Tennessee and Maryland and so forth, and yet remained with the North. But he said, you know, if we lose Kentucky, we'll lose everything. If Kentucky goes with us, and they're trembling on the edge. If he was uncautious about things, several of these states could have easily tumbled into the South, and then the North would have lost the Civil War. So by the end, and he realized that the North was going to win the war by September of 1864. He really was driving now toward emancipation. He had already issued the Emancipation Proclamation, and he was pushing hard for the 13th Amendment, which is the subject of Spielberg's movie Lincoln, about the passage of the amendment that abolished slavery. And Lincoln, toward the end, was very much pushing for emancipation by that time.
So one of the things he suggests, I think he was questioned as to how long slavery might last. This before the Civil War, and he suggested it could be 50 to 100 years. It seems to me that he saw it maybe dying out, but he certainly had a long time frame.
Yeah, a lot of people were wondering how long it would take. Some people said 25 years. Some, you know, he said it could be a century. If you can imagine slavery around in 1958, he said that in 1858. But he was just talking about the sheer electoral process. You know, if he just went through election, 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 and at the time he said that, the elections were very much dominated by the Southern Democrats, by slaveholders. 12 American presidents owned slaves, and most Supreme Court justices owned slaves. I mean, it was largely a pro-slavery system, so he had to envisage the disappearance of this political powerhouse of slavery. And he said, well, it could take 50 years, it could take 100 years, but I just wanted to leave. At that time, he wasn't thinking about civil war.
I want to turn to his three major addresses, which is first inaugural, which seems to be one in which he tries to certainly extend some kind of reaching hand to the South. The Gettysburg address talks about equality. But in the end, as you mentioned a moment ago, in the second inaugural, not only does he denounce slavery, but he says, and as you point out, malice toward none, charity to all. But then he goes on to say, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right. In other words, he seems to be going, saying, yes, we're going to do these things, but there's also an issue of being right.
Yeah, and he always thought that there was a right and a wrong about slavery. It was right that slavery should be abolished. It was wrong to support slavery. But in the second inaugural, he actually uses that word very forcefully and says that we have to go forward toward human justice, toward progress. We can't go backward into slavery. And he would have been appalled by what happened during Jim Crow later on, when there was segregation and discrimination and all that. So, but he did lay the groundwork for human rights by supporting the 13th Amendment and by waging the war that ended slavery in America. And then after his death, there was the 14th Amendment and then the 15th Amendment, which gave voting rights and citizenship to African-American males. Women would come later in 1920. But And the point is that he wants to always progress toward human rights and toward justice.
One of the things, by the way, you point out is that he really begins what may be a modern industrial era with a government, strong government action, federal action from agriculture department to banking and so on. Describe a little bit about that, because it seems as if the Civil War in his particular period really begins what could be the nascent moment of the progressive era.
Yeah, he envisaged, he had a very expansive view of the government. He thought that the government should actually do everything that, you know, normal people just are powerless to do, that the government should be there for them. And when he supported the Homestead Act in 1862, he was literally giving away many, many acres to thousands, and it turned out millions of people, almost for free. These were Western acres, Western homesteads. And the monetary system, he wanted to stabilize it. And that's why he authorized greenbacks, which were the ancestor of the dollar, because there were American currencies were produced by states, and there were all these different states, and they're all. So he centralized banking, and he wanted a very expansive government that would really help average Americans.
Finally, in terms of that cultural divide that we started out with, it seems as if certainly he eliminated slavery, but that cultural divide continued on certainly into Jim Crow, and I was curious about whether or not you see that continuing on even into our own era.
It goes in waves. Just after he died, African Americans made a big, big progress down in the South, but then fairly quickly, there was a reaction. This was during Reconstruction, and white supremacy raised its ugly head again. And that kind of, you know, gave rise to Jim Crow in the 1880s all the way up to 1954, when there was lynching of black people and legalized segregation. Then you had the civil rights movement of the late 1950s and the 1960s. And Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. But then you had the rise of kind of a right-wing conservatism that kind of lasts until today. And that's why you have such huge political and cultural divisions in our era.
Just briefly, do you think then that the current President Donald Trump then represents that divide?
Yeah. He's very much unlike Lincoln. He likes to compare himself to Lincoln, but he's not at all like Lincoln. Lincoln did not play to a political base. He thought the worst thing you could do is to pour gasoline on the flame of divisions. And he didn't even call out his political enemies in any kind of ad hominem or in a kind of nasty way whatsoever. He just affirmed what he thought was right and just for all people, and he really did have charity for all.
We've been speaking with David Reynolds. He's authored a new book entitled Abraham Lincoln in His Times, which traces the cultural changes as well as the political that has shaped the man we now know as the Great Emancipator. We appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Don. Appreciate it.
We now turn to the modern Republican Party. It was in the mid-1960s that the grand old party changed dramatically, sweeping up the formerly solid Democratic South and leaving behind the solid Republican African-American vote. We now turn to Salisbury University political science professor Michael Laughlin. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Don.
So let's begin with Goldwater, because it seems to me that is sort of the turning point of this party in terms of its shift to the right and its viewing the formerly white segregationist South, the Dixiecrats, as it were, as really stuff that which they could make a major party.
Well, I think you see really there are two players here. There's, on the one hand, Goldwater and his supporters within the Republican Party, and of course Lyndon Johnson and the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, and Johnson strikes hard with supporting the civil rights movement, of course passing the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and then of course moving on beyond that to the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And then you have Goldwater, of course, who stands fast with for states' rights. He votes against the Civil Rights Act in 1964. And in effect, then, the cleft is drawn here. And you see then the Democratic Party becoming a party which then maximizes the black community's vote. And the Republican Party now becomes the party, in effect, of the white South. So the solid South changes from the solid South voting Democratic now up to the present day, voting in favor of the Republican candidates and Republican Party.
Well, one of the things that's really interesting, of course, is that there's the role of George Wallace, who actually played a significant role in the 1968 election. But Nixon himself looks at that Wallace vote and seems to be saying, that's something I got to scoop up. And then we're talking about voters not only in the South, but also in the North.
Well, at this point, I think that part of what happens particularly with Nixon, I mean, Nixon is the one who picks up essentially the baton from Goldwater, is they strike a devil's bargain. Because the new strategy that comes forward with the law and order is to exploit the racial divide within the country. And up until the very present, clearly with Trump is echoing this, in effect, picking up a racist strategy to keep that racial tension hot, okay, in order to mobilize white voters who look to the past and not to the future. And what happens additionally, of course, is that in the 70s, you pick up the constituency of the Christian right. I mean, I think what we find, so you have this combination of the essentially a nativist white South with the Christian right. Often these folks overlap, but also a corporate elite. So there is this uneasy alliance, in effect, that emerges, particularly in the 70s, and I think as the Republican Party has really glommed on to the Southern strategy now, this law and order strategy, but also to protect corporate power and corporate flexibility. So that's what we have within, I mean, Donald Trump in effect is is almost a natural exhibit of what we would expect the evolution of the Republican Party to become. So the Republican Party has in effect become an authoritarian party because they cling to an increasingly smaller part of the demographic and the electorate, okay? And in order to retain power, they must take actions that in effect repress the vote to prevent the expansion of a much more diverse demographic, which at this point in the two parties' histories is actually benefiting, of course, now the Democratic Party to the detriment of the Republican Party.
Before we leave the 1960s, one of the things that also struck me is that many of the whites who turned to the Republican Party were also reacting to the sort of cultural upheaval that we saw during the 1960s, obviously against the counterculture, but also against all the various movements, whether it's feminism or it's the civil rights movement, or obviously at the end there was a gay rights movement as well with the Stonewall. Yes. It does seem as if there's that reaction to that upheaval, which almost seems almost unique to the decade.
Yes, I think, and again, the language that comes forward, of course, is the whole notion of the culture wars. And the culture wars really involve, when you get at the essence of them, this reaction in effect, egalitarian movements, egalitarian, more democratic, democratizing movements. So beyond the civil rights movement, of course, you have the women's movement and the gay rights movement. And these are all essentially democratic, egalitarian movements, expanding basic rights. Okay, and unfortunately for our society, we have this part of the white community essentially is reactionary against these wishes to restrain that kind of movement. And that clearly plays out early on with Nixon. And again, the Republican Party has become the party of the past. And in effect, then it's a reactionary development here. And again, if we listen to the hearings with Judge Barrett, the whole fear is that she may be part of the court that will try to reverse all of these advances, essentially in egalitarian politics.
I want to turn then now to Newt Gingrich, who obviously became the House Speaker after the 1994 election. But one of the things he engineered was this sort of scorched earth tactics. I mean, he began that with against Jim Wright, who was the Democratic House Speaker in the 1980s. But he ramped them up, and it seems as if that is one of the keys to the Republican Party, not only getting into the White House, obviously, but taking control of Congress.
For sure. And for a time, those kinds of tactics worked. And so that if you can maximize the turnout of that segment of the white community, and you can maximize the turnout of the Christian right, then for a certain time period, that is going to work in terms of the electorate. Unfortunately for that strategy, we are now moving towards essentially a majority-minority electorate, so that the black community, the black minority, plus the Hispanic community, plus the Asian community, and plus a certain percentage of the white community, makes up, therefore, a larger electorate for Democrats. So.
But it does seem to me that the tactics that Gingrich utilized, that they have now been ginned up to even be perhaps even more effective, at least on a temporary basis, with things like social media, which is something that Gingrich did not have in the 1990s. I mean, you get these memes out there, which are we talk now about fake news, about misinformation, and so on. That's more easily spread than it was in 1994.
Absolutely, yes. And it has been effective. I mean, I think one of the reasons, again, why Donald Trump still has, in effect, a fighting chance is because of that capacity to mobilize those constituent parts of the electorate. I mean, the polling does indicate that there's an enthusiasm there's greater enthusiasm for the Trump reelection than there is for the Biden challenge at this point. And I think much has to do with the ability to capitalize on social media and on a major television station that is able to promote Trumpism for this election.
I want to turn to the issue of immigration because there's sort of like two stories here. On the one hand, we had, for instance, President Reagan, who offered up amnesty in the mid-1980s. George W. Bush talked about immigration reform. On the other hand, we had California Governor Pete Wilson, who attempted to capitalize on anti-immigrant sentiment with an initiative that failed. And in California, that has essentially wiped out the GOP in terms of really any kind of statewide effectiveness. I'm kind of curious about where you think that party is now with immigration, especially given the fact that one of the fastest growing population in the United States is Hispanic.
Yes. This is a great question, because what this helps to reveal then is that, I mean, within any political party, there's an evolution of how it's going to, the dynamic where it's going to go. And it's clearly the case, I think, that within the Republican Party, and this was really cited by even people like former Senator Orrin Hatch, I think, a number of years ago, basically said, you know, unless the Republican Party is able to draw in, in particular Hispanic voters in greater percentages, and even try to get black voters to come over us, we're going to be doomed to a minority status. And so I think that at times you have seen, I mean, the Reagan case, I think, is an interesting one, because that was at least one proposal to try, in effect, to do that, to try to be more open to immigration, to be more welcoming. I mean, even Jeb Bush, actually, in the 2016 election, was attempting to do that. But he was clearly beaten badly, so that the force within the Republican Party now, what the dynamics within the Republican Party now has taken on a Trumpist, anti-immigrant, almost, really a xenophobic attitude towards immigration, not simply undocumented immigration, but even legal immigration. I mean, it's an amazing effort here. There's an amazing position that the Republican Party is now in under Trump, and whether or not they can get out from under that is another question. I mean, I think it's safe to say, unless they find a way of getting out from under an anti-immigrant position, they will doom themselves, I think, in the future to minority status, at least in terms of electoral politics.
In the minute or so we have left, I want to turn to this idea that there are a lot of Trump supporters. They came out certainly in 2016 to overwhelm whatever establishment candidates there were. Even if Donald Trump is defeated in this November, that doesn't mean necessarily that they're going to go away. So trying to look forward, how do you see those Trump supporters, Trumpism, for lack of a better word, in relationship to certainly the traditional party leaders and this party? I mean, is it that the party going to be changed forever, or do you think there might be merely a blip when it comes to Trump and the kind of party that he's at least shaped so far?
One of the real questions for me in trying to think through this is how important is Donald Trump to Trumpism? On the one hand, I think that Trump may be the kind of a charismatic leader that is critical to this kind of movement, so that if he fades away, if he loses the election, is there anybody else who can actually pick up that leadership position with the kind of power that Trump has? I mean, I think there's no question he has been a powerful figure in keeping this movement going. If there is not, okay, then it gives the opportunity for the remnants of those Republicans, and it's hard to see who they are, but at this point, but who wish to essentially retreat from this kind of reactionary, this really more authoritarian instinct and divide here, and to try to come back to a former position for the Republican Party that could then be more competitive and then perhaps more open to democratic and egalitarian perspectives. But it's hard. It's hard to say exactly where it's going to go at this point in time, I think. It all really has to do with, I think, what kind of position Trump actually has played in the development of this movement and in its preservation.
We've been speaking with Michael Laughlin. He's a political science professor at Salisbury University, and we appreciate you taking time to talk with us this morning.
My pleasure, Don.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.